That it's not going to be problematic because, you know, they've got an unqualified report and they've been engaging a lot on what they're really doing to fund it. So hopefully we'll be able to find finish in a reasonable period of time. Then somewhere in between, we have to put in the passing of the report for the Department of Water. There is a draft, but I'm rewriting. I don't think there's anything, I'm not raising any controversial issues of race, no, the crisis, the leaders have got to stop, so I'm not facing it, but it could be that one leads out now that I'm trying to do something. And then, of course, in the science putting somewhere the environmental affairs of the drafting from today, and in some way I also want to finalize the Mexican report. I've taken that to a high level of completion. I think there's some information there that's not necessary, it's a bit too much cumbersome. So the cleaning up act there, so we're close to finish there as well. I want to try and finalize that as well. And then obviously if there are any issues that are standing over from today, we'll of course continue with them tomorrow. And then tomorrow we'll really have to try and pass the call and have to work on it. So that's really our program. Next week, we do have Tuesday available, and unfortunately, I'm not here in country. But if it's necessary for us to pass the environmental report, we can still do it Tuesday morning next week. But if we can draft something by today and tomorrow, we'll probably try to do it. So, as you can see, exit. And then we haven't finalized the second term program yet. You will recall that the kind of things we're going to deal with are the water tariff. Just the information I've seen is a bit worrying to me. It seems that some of the increases are new. And I'm still trying to grapple with how that process works. And it's not clear to me, and it's not clear what we're trying to do. And so, but that we'll be doing, and of course, the acid mine drainage, and then a lot of the issues that have arisen. Hearing the example, there's some good reports I want to have come to deliver here. So it's going to be a cool program. You're going to have to wait for the June part of the year. And I haven't been able to find that. So that is just quickly to sketch our program for the next one. The Professor, once again, can I say very welcome to you.
I wanted to say it, but I wasn't able to get a chance to ask a question the other day in the seminar, but I know Professor Swinney from a long time ago. At one stage when we were fighting trials, at the stage when the apartheid state really started getting serious about these trials, and a lot of evidence was being led about the liberation struggle and so on. There was a group of experts, of which Professor Swilling was one of them, that used to come and give evidence in court. So he's got a long history of being involved in progressive issues. And I think when he had input this morning, you'll see he's one of the, not that I know much about economics, but I definitely, the things I heard him say, was one of the foremost thinkers on more progressive thinking around economic issues. So I think it's a really honor and a privilege for us to have him here. And I hope that this will be a start of a long relationship with the committee where we can call upon you with these issues. So over to you, Professor, and once again, welcome here.
Rising levels of education and expanding levels of and the usefulness of the African continent in the scope. But what's most interesting about the situation of our moment in Africa is that although Africa's development is seen as primarily about the exploitation of resources, the resource sectors are declining as diversification and this is really the ground for the new optimism in South Africa. The McKinsey report clusters African countries into four different clusters. On the top left here, you see the traditional resource dependent, primarily oil exporters. Nigeria, Algeria, Libya, Angola, Congo, Chad, Gabon, countries which have very limited diversification. And as a result, because their resource spend is very unequal and also have growth challenges. On the other side of the table, you see South Africa, Tunisia, Namibia, Egypt, Cote d'Ivoire, Mauritius, as countries that have increased their diversification. So they're not just dependent on resource exploitation, there's a multiplicity of sectors that are showing signs of growth. Well, South Africa is a bit controversial because we're strong. And then there's a set of countries in between the usual basket sectors, which are just the kind of countries that struggle with development. There are a set of convergent countries, Kenya, Mozambique, Uganda, Tanzania, Ghana. These are countries that are beginning to figure out ways of moving beyond the resource dependent that causes in the country. So these are the clustering of the African context. But when you start thinking about African development in the global context of the resource depletion and the constraints to development as a result of resource depletion, we need to consider the diagram, which really on the bottom of the diagram, you have the Human Development Index, all the countries of the world can activate the Human Development Index at the bottom. And on the column on the right, the vertical column, is the ecological footprint. It basically is a very rough measure of the ecological resources that a particular economy is dependent on. So you can see on the top right hand side, you'll have the orange dot, which is on the North American economy, so they're high on the Human Development Index, high on the ecological footprint. When you're high on the ecological footprint, you're unsustainable. The objective of sustainability is to move down the ecological footprint to become unsustainable. If you look then at the blue dot on the right hand side, that was basically your European economy. The red dot clusters at the intersection between HDI and ecological footprint by Latin American countries. The green dots, which are spread, as you can see, right across from where European countries are, right down to where many of the African countries are, which are the other side, are your Asian countries. So obviously, you have South Korea on the one side and very poor Asian countries on the other side. But you'll see that the yellow dots, which are African countries, are fairly heavily concentrated at low levels of human development, index. But also low levels, low down in the ecological footprint. Now, what this diagram should conjure up in your mind is if you're interested in African countries moving up the human development index, and if that means simultaneously moving up the ecological footprint, which is the traditional definition of development, then you have a problem in a world which first time we're facing constraints, such as resource depletion constraints, as well as climate constraints, the traditional forms of economic development. And you probably also know that there's only one country that is in the intersection between HDI and the ecological footprint, which is Cuba, which is really a consequence of the fact that Cuba was forced to get on oil. So what this diagram should lead you to think of conceptions of development that Africa would be applicable to African countries, that would make it possible to move up the human development index without necessarily moving drastically up the ecological level. And that's really the articulation of the core economic development challenge when you're taking into account the world, facing the consequences of the world's depletion on one hand and the climate limits on the other. If you think that there is no other development other than a resource, I said called a resource, an energy intensive growth path, then yes, you will basically believe that it is possible for African countries to move up into development index and move up ecological footprint without necessarily incurring costs for doing that. I mean, not a lot of people who can substantiate that. So you have to start to think about alternative conceptions. Really, this is what the resource panel is going to do. Let me put this into a bit of an historical context. What I've put up here is, in a very rough, in a simplistic way, is the economic growth wave that we have gone through since the beginning of the industrial revolution. In the beginning, the industrial revolution really began with water power, mechanization, textile commerce, and that went growth and goes into the time. The next wave, which is basically steam power, railroads, cotton production, that goes into the food and comes down. And then your third wave, the electricity, chemicals, the combustion engine, rises and comes down. And as it comes down, the next wave is the beginning. Chemicals, power, pyro, electronic radiation, space, and along the way, one, two, world war. And then you move in from the 1970s into the digital revolution, the information technology revolution, which is now hit its prime. So the 2007-2008, you could go back to the dot-com crisis, but 2007-2008 was really the crisis of the information age. But at the peak point of all of these curves, there's a major economic crisis. So we've had five major, massive economic crises, which really leads to the downturn in the beginning of the year. Now there's a very interesting fact about all of the upturns, that if you cast your eyes to the upturns, at every single point of all the upturns, you have had a very distinct advantage in the world, and that is if you have access to cheap primary resources, whether that was through new technology or through accessing new geographical areas where these resources are located, since colonialism is on, you were able to access people, whether that's food, whether that's energy, whether it's iron ore, whatever the case is, accessing these cheap primary resources was critical for the recovery. The challenge we face today is that you can't access cheap primary resources. Commodity prices and primary resources are in the industry. And this is a fundamental difference in the world today between the economic recovery that we're interested in now at a global level and the previous economic recovery. And really, what I've just said is really at the heart of an economist's perspective that the world faces, which is how to reestablish without assuming that it is possible to access what we've always been able to access in previous outcomes, on achievement. So how do you start to get it? Now, in my view, Africa's core challenge is really revolved around the fact that its exports are still heavily primary resources. Even for that probably up to 30-40-50% of our exports comes from Africa. Africa is dependent on, very, very dependent on exports in climate change. But Africa's only really got a chance of figuring out an alternative growth path if some of the resource rents, the profits generated from these exports are invested in capital, in infrastructure, in sustainability-oriented technological innovation. decoupled economic growth from resources, and I'll explain what I mean by that, and the restoration of renewable resources. And I use the word restoration because you're dependent on renewable resources like water, like soil, like biomass, and if you over exploit them, they run down. Now, this diagram is at the heart of our work. What it demonstrates, and this is very, very new, so it hasn't ever been brought together before, and the essence of a report that I have co-authored with my colleagues at the panel, which was released in New York, and decided in the Commission on Sustainable Development in May. And what you're looking at here is two things. Firstly, a way of packaging the world resources that we depend on. So there are four packages of resources. Construction minerals, which is things like your cement, your gravel, your sand, forestry, which is both like this. Or an industrial mineral, which is your metal. The fossil fuel carriers, which is your oil, coal, and gas. Biomass, which is not just food, but also cotton, and clothes, and so on, and goods. So these are the four packages of resources that we take for granted, that the global economy is dependent on. And as you can see, over the previous 10 years, there's been a change in the pattern of resources. On the one hand, there's been a radical and a very substantial increase in the quantum of resources that we've been from the 1960s. If you just focus on the period 1980 to the year 2005, just that 25-year period, that's an increase of 36% in the total quantum of stuff that you actually need. Now, what I should add here, this is the quantum of resources, and now we're at about 50 billion tons of stuff that we extract from the substitutes and use. We actually extract double that, about 120 billion tons. If we don't, we only use half of what we extract. The rest of that is unusable in one term to keep off the environment. So what you have here is a 36% increase in the amount of stuff we extract and use over the last 20 to 25 years, a period of accelerated growth. But there's another interesting shift here. And if you look back to the 1950s, you'll see that by the 1950s, the global economy was actually primarily dependent on biomass. And it's only with your stuff that you grow. Not only since the 1950s, 1960s, that we've become more dependent on non-biomass materials, the construction minerals, the gravel, the mining fuels, the metal oils, and so on and so forth. And that, when people are talking about how do you get back to an economy dependent on renewables, it has actually happened before. It was something called pollution and profit, but it wasn't that long ago. And so this is the touch. Another interesting dimension of this system is that you can see GDP growth has grown faster than when we bought it. In other words, there's a spontaneous, what we call a spontaneous decoupling already, without much policy effort, between the growth in resources on one hand, the four packages together, and your GDP growth. So that suggests that it is possible. You can start to think in terms of growth that is more and more efficient in the way in which we utilize the resources. And that's a key element of what it means to become more sustainable. So what we did in this resource panel is set up a set of scenarios. So in an academic way, the modern version of the medical article, which everybody seems to believe in, and that's the generation of power. And this is one of the important times where we said, okay, let's assume that the world population is going to grow from 6 to 9 billion, which is more of a 6 to 9 billion people by 2050. In other words, we're looking at another 3 billion people that are going to be on the planet. So this is put that in perspective, when my mother and all the babies were in the country, there were only 2.5 billion people in the country. But more is during my lifetime, the global population has doubled. And I'm probably might still be alive by 2050. Probably not. But another 3 billion people will be there. Now that is going to have major implications. So what you have on the left-hand side is the baseline, which is 50 billion tons of stuff. That's the picture I've already showed. If you run the economy more or less on a business as usual basis, the projection is that we'll need 140 billion tons of stuff. That's the second bar. Now, if you just focus on those two and you go to the right-hand table, you'll see that at the moment, at 6 billion people, just over 6 billion people, at 50 billion tons, we're consuming 8 tons per capita each of stuff per year, on average. Some countries, like low-density industrialized countries like Canada, the US, Australia, are actually at around 20 to 30 tons per capita. Europeans are at about 15 tons per capita, and Latin American countries, including South Africa, we're around 8 to 9 tons, 10 tons per capita. That's the breakdown. But if you see the world as an average system, we're on average 8 tons per capita. Now, if you say, okay, let the world converge at the level of the average European, which is 15 tons. For that, at 9 billion people, you'll need 140 billion tons of stuff. Now, just that alone is very controversial. Because it means for countries like low-density industrialized countries that are resource and energy intensive, like Canada, the US, and Australia, it's a significant drop from 20, 30 tons down to 15, 15 tons. But moving to 15 tons is for some countries sustainable. But if everybody converges to that point, you need 140 billion. Now, you're not going to find a scientist or a geologist or a resource economist who's going to be able to stand up, put their hand on their arm, and say, yes, my science tells me that we have that quantum resource. What? Now, this causes you a bit of a problem. If you run the economy on the assumption that those resources are available, but there's nobody from the science perspective on that. We're basically just walking out on a branch and waiting for the break. So this is the essence of it. So if you say, well, let's introduce a little bit of spend. Let's have a cutoff point of 70 billion, which is the third column, which will all be converging at 9 billion people at average consumption rate. 8 tons. And that would mean for developing countries catching up, eliminating poverty by 2030 at 8 tons per capita. But it would mean very, very drastic reduction in consumption of primary resources by developing economies. But if you want to run the global economy according to the science in the IPCC report, and don't forget, the IPCC stands for Intergovernmental. It stands for IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The fourth assessment report was signed by the government of the world, including ours, and got the Nobel Prize. It's like a complex and heavy process to actually formulate the report. Elements of the panel. So the world, you could say, signed off on a body of science, which has economic implications. If we model those it means actually running the economy on the assumption that you don't go beyond 50 billion tons. In other words, it's the fourth bar in the left-hand side, which means converging at 6 tons per capita. So we've agreed to the science and policy makers to basically 6 tons per capita, but we don't realize it. And we don't want to think about it, because it has big drastic economic impact, it's a revolution. And that, I think that river revolution is the boundary, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. And the question is whether it's part of that revolution or not. Because this is not something that you debate in abstract. These are real, tangible, material things that determine choice, that determine technology. We don't like sitting debate, you know, whether oil is getting more expensive. We know it's actually happening out there, and that's driving certain market dynamics, which results in things to say alternative technology. So these are hard materials, right? These are not the typical things. So we then move to another level and start developing an economic theory that can start helping us think about how you transform the global economy. And we start introducing this idea of the economy. This is just a very, very simple rendition of the theory. The first thing we make a distinction between resource and impact income. And this is a very important distinction, which is frequently not understood. When most of you think about what environmentalists are worried about, you're actually normally thinking about impact, the environmental impact of production. Now, that is what most people, particularly in the developing world, think environmentalism is about. It's about decoupling the impact, the environmental impact of production consumption from growth or from the Our panel is not really that a certain environmental does not fall that into that because it's heavily populated territory. Lots of people are in that world, are worrying about impact. What I'm more interested in, particularly from an economist point of view, is what we call resource decoupling. Resource decoupling doesn't refer to the impact of production of the economy, but the input, the resources that you need to go into the economy in order to make it work. And what we're talking about there, then, is the decoupling of the quantum of resources that are required. You get the same amount of economic value and or well-being. In other words, doing more with less. That's the essence of it. And that really begins to start opening up the possibility of decoupling, in particular economic growth, GDP growth, from the resources that you need. When you start doing that, as an aside, as a kind of footnote, although I would never make this explicit in the UN forum, you actually are slowly reinventing what drugs mean. You're creating what I call a soft landing into more progressive orbits in the air rather than just doing I want you just to really hang on to this image that of decoupling, of GDP growth from people. If you summarize the little points that I've made up until now, and you say, well, what is sustainability really about? It's really about moving from a way of living, a way of running our economy that runs down